And homeoresis in general is like actually going on a positive trajectory. That's why I like to think about it like growth. You go from small to big while you stay in homeostasis, but you stay, you go in a positive direction. And as long as you stay in balance and you have enough nutrition and that sort of thing, you can meet your maximal phenotype, maybe. You know, you could be the biggest bird, but if you get moderate nutrition, your homeoretic or the adjustments you make in your metabolism and your growth and that sort of thing can be, if your nutrition is half, you'll grow half your height. And if it's really low, you'll grow to the minimum of your height.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Boost digestive health, performance, and profitability with Digesterone Prime, a feed additive that enhances digestion and immune function in dairy calves. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/prime. Exalit, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Agrarian Solutions, research-backed microbial solutions for healthier, higher-performing livestock. AgriComfort, the cow comfort specialist, because her longevity is your legacy.
Hello and welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Dr. Teresa Casey. Dr. Casey is an associate professor just down the road from me at Purdue University in Indiana. Dr. Casey, thanks for joining.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we've known each other for some time, but I don't really know your whole story. Did you sort of grow up in agriculture, or did you migrate into this through biology? How'd you get here?
No, I think, to be honest with you, I think the thing is that how did I end up here? I ended up here because I met Karen Clout many years ago. I would say, like, I am in the heart of hearts a real basic biologist. I met Karen because she taught reproductive physiology, and I wanted to take the class. This was post, it was like a post-bac program. My dad is a obstetrician or obstetrics kind of, he's really actually a gynecologic oncologist. He studies cancer, and I met Karen, and I, through him, maybe I was interested in reproduction quite a bit. And then, also cancer. And she kind of, even though she was in the animal sciences department, it was sort of a good niche area for me. And I was also really, really very interested in developmental biology. Like, one of my favorite classes I took as an undergraduate was developmental biology. And actually, in that book, I will always remember this, and because when I was writing my thesis and then my dissertation, which was all on mammary gland development. I digress, but it was a paper by Kratich Will or something from, or it could have been Prop from 1959, but they like took the mesenchyme and they took the mammary gland cells and they put it in the salivary gland, and they took the salivary gland and put them in the mammary gland.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and showed that they, like, if you put epithelial cells, whatever the cell, it grew like a salivary gland. But anyway, I ended up there. So
this was at Vermont University?
Yeah, this was at the University of Vermont. And then I did my master's and PhD there. So I will always say, like, embarrassingly, you know, like how you always feel like you're sometimes don't belong somewhere, that I was raised in an animal sciences department. The first time I ever heard culling a cow, I ran home, and this is during my master's program, and I went to a book, and I'm like, what does cull mean? I think it means, and then I didn't realize it was sort of like, yeah, you got her out of the herd. And Yeah. So if, so I know animal sciences because I've been there for over 30 years, but not my natural predilection. I do have a small hobby farm though, if that counts, you know.
Yeah, right? That's cool.
Yeah. Goats and chickens, and I love animals. I learned to love pigs too. So, and dairy cows.
But, well, we're glad you chose animal science.
It's, yes. Yeah.
So tell us a little more about your day-to-day work today at Purdue.
Oh, wow. Day-to-day work. I'm a research track professor. I do teach a class every once in a while. I will have to say I left graduate school and I taught full time for 5 years and then returned to research, which probably is where I belong because that's where I've been for the last 25 years. Do a lot of mentoring of my graduate students and postdocs. I write a ton of grants. I probably get less than 1% of what I write. A lot of papers. I do a lot of reading. I think that's like, you know, basically like where you end up at this kind of job, like, you know, analyzing your data, talking about your data, mentoring your students. That's a big component. I'm writing a lot of grants.
This is kind of off track, but isn't it interesting? My wife teaches middle school literature and she has students and even some parents, they're like, all that really matters is science and math. You don't have to pay attention to that. And it's like, so dumb. It's like scientists spend 3/4 of their time reading and writing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny when you will meet students and they say they want to get their PhD and they're like, they don't like to read or write. And I'm like, wow, that's your whole job when you get to here. Now, there are the times that, you know, you have a big trial and, but I say to all my students, I'm like, I don't know what to do anymore. So like I do the stuff that's more like, I don't know, bottle feeding the pigs or feeding their food or taking like the, I did a lot of circadian rhythm biology research. So we sample through the night. So I'm always taking like the midnight thing, but they don't want me to do anything in the lab anymore. So reading and writing.
Help your calves with digestive health and boost performance. By enhancing feed intake and supporting gut health, Digesterone Prime boosts your dairy calves' immunity and growth while increasing profitability. Plus, it has no withdrawal periods, making it a smart choice for your feeding program. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/prime.
Well, today I think we're going to talk a little bit about a term that I think might risk scaring some people off. So I'm going to ask people, you know, trigger warning if you don't like big words. But actually, if we explain it, it's a really interesting concept. So can you define homeoresis for us?
I think we should start with homeostasis and then get into homeoresis. And I remember when I was trying to figure out how to teach, I would say to the students, and actually biology isn't really that hard. Is we just have these big words and we scare a lot of people away with jargon. And so, so homeostasis means, you know, it's really like how you can keep your body in balance. And what I mean by balance is you don't want to be too tired or you don't want to be excessively active. You need an inside of your body, right? So you don't want your blood sugar to be too high or too low, but there's a range that's really important to keep balance and to be healthy. And if you're balanced and healthy, right, you are in homeostasis. And probably a lot of people, I hear all the lay people using homeostasis all the time. And like conceptually, I was like, that's a really hard conceptual, but I think a lot of people are accepting that word. So then what's homeoresis? And so I actually think, you know, we meaning you and I talk a lot about it in terms of getting ready for lactation or supporting the growth of the fetus or that sort of thing. But I think growth is probably one of the better analogies. And that is like, how can you keep yourself in balance, but put a lot of as much energy as you can to reach a goal? And the goal would be your height or your weight or your muscles or that sort of thing. So that's like where homeostasis is. You can, if you get too high, you want to bring it down. If you get too low, you want to bring it up. And homeoresis in general is like actually going on a positive trajectory. That's why I like to think about it like growth. You go from small to big while you stay in homeostasis, but you stay, you go in a positive direction. And as long as you stay in balance and you have enough nutrition and that sort of thing, you can meet your maximal phenotype, maybe. You know, you could be the biggest bird, but if you get moderate nutrition, your homeoretic or the adjustments you make in your metabolism and your growth and that sort of thing can be, if your nutrition is half, you'll grow half your height. And if it's really low, you'll grow to the minimum of your height. So I guess that's, I don't know, that's how I explain homeostasis to, or homeoresis to students. If, does that make sort of sense?
And that actually brings to mind some examples I used to use in a basic cross-species nutrition class, where I don't know a lot about this. You probably know a lot more. If you feed excessive calcium to certain breeds of young dogs, they'll actually grow so fast that they end up with bone deformities.
Yeah. And so I mean, I don't know that, but yes, I can see that.
It's sort of a loss of that. Yeah, they're trying to grow, but they're losing the ability to maintain homeostasis during that growth, right? Because it's gotten out of control. So I think, yeah, that kind of makes the point nicely there.
Yeah. There's this, for those people who are interested in lactation out there, and my kind of obsession with the circadian rhythm stuff is, but you know, lactose synthesis has a peak of one sort of time of the day and a low, and a peak and a low. When you watch lactose synthesis take off from nothing, because we don't make lactose, which is milk sugar, before lactation begins to its maximal height, you see it go up and down, up and down, up and down, following this positive trajectory. So you sort of see, you see the circadian rhythm of it, which the circadian rhythm, which is the changes in a metabolic capacity of during the day. But it's part of our homeostatic system, right? So we balance. It's part of our homeostatic system, but you see this like positive trajectory going up. And I think that that's a really cool thing. Like putting one on top of the other over time is kind of cool.
So you got daily rhythms and annual rhythms, and then like lifetime rhythms, right?
Yeah. And then like homeoresis also, like where homeostasis is kind of like an immediate response to stay in balance, right? And a lot often, most often by negative feedback, homeoresis is by positive feedback in general. When you think about it in growth, and you look like you don't agree. Do you not agree?
No,
it's
I do.
Positive feedback. Oh, okay.
I'm just trying to keep up with you. You know, I got smoke around my ears.
Yeah. I talk too fast, but I love to like hear other people's opinions. Like if you don't agree, then that would be good, because it's actually a really hard thing to talk about, I think, homeoresis, and explain.
Yeah. What I was kind of thinking about is, again, some of this may be just sort of speculation or your opinions or thoughts, but you know, I grew up on a beef operation. Like genetically, those animals are, I don't know, maybe 0.1% of the DNA is different than like a modern Holstein cow. And yet lactation looks so different, right? So how do you think about that in terms of this homeoresis? This animal has to sort of adapt to such a bigger change. Do you think that's, some people I know think we've gone too far and that's, you know, straining the system, or how do you think about that?
So that the transition from pregnancy to lactation, right? And that, those are huge homeoretic, hopefully, like positive trajectory and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I always say to students, I like to say shocking things so you will remember. But I say this about like women, humans, or cows, or mice, right? Like if you study this in mice or rodents, that at the end of gestation, if a human female was a 50-year-old man, you would say she was like not healthy, right? Like she's in a state of hyperlipidemia or triglyceridemia, which like, so she has high circulating levels of fat. She maybe is insulin resistant, right? Like, so that's a big change for homeoresis to get, so you stop. So you're making all these metabolic changes so you can support the growth of the fetus and then eventually so you can make milk. And so so if you took those spot on measures and how we defined health and disease, you might say that, but she's actually still in homeostasis. But if those things go too far, like in a cow, she can be in ketosis and develop liver disease. In humans, we can get preeclampsia. We can get gestational diabetes. So yeah, so if those metabolic adaptations go too far, whether we've selected for them maybe genetically in the Holstein cow, or we have something that's causing us to be unbalanced in some way, yeah, you can tip to disease, I think, easily. Like, yeah, so staying in balance is the key for good homeoretic adaptations to those. And that's the other thing, is I think part of Dale Bauman's definition is in a dominant physiological state, like, right? So, so once you decide to reproduce, right, you got to put all the energy toward the growth of the fetus, you know, and then milk production. And even if you have underlying imbalances for whatever reason, like too fat of a cow or whatever, not enough energy or not enough calcium, those changes have to occur anyway, because the baby's got to come out, right? And yeah, we can tip things. And I think that that's a really important thing about nutrition. You know, working with Jackie Bowerman, a lot of her stuff is, you know, in muscle reserves and starting to look at the dry cow, like how can we help her better balance to get into to avoid the diseases, because, you know, the cow's going to make these adjustments in her metabolism to accommodate this dominant thing, which is lactation, and how can we help her stay in homeostasis? So yeah, so maybe a beef cow isn't as pressured to make as much, or genetically selected to make as much milk, just really to support her calf, which is normal.
Maybe more nutritionally constrained, but yeah, the demands are not as great.
Yeah, yeah.
Evonik is committed to help supply a growing world population with healthy and affordable animal protein while prioritizing animal welfare, the efficient use of natural resources, and food safety. Evonik's expertise in low-protein diets and supplemental amino acids help ruminant farmers around the globe to enhance feed efficiency, reduce costs, improve animal health, and lower greenhouse gas and nitrogen emissions.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're talking about some of the work Jackie's doing, and I also think, like, anionic diets for dry cows is a great example. And the way I try to frame it is, it's sort of like she's going to go run a marathon on this fixed date, right? We train her for it. Or, you know, she can sit on the couch for 3 months ahead of time, and then she just has to get on, you know, lace up the sneakers and run. And obviously it's going to be better to train.
Yeah.
It's like making the system ready to adapt to that better.
Yeah.
Are there examples we're missing? Are there ideas you have of other things we should be doing to sort of train her for that challenge?
I mean, I think that that's probably one of the big things, like your audience in terms of dairy management and dairy nutrition. I mean, I think nutrition is probably the most important thing, but, you know, I think that, you know, minimizing stress, right? Like stress is, and, you know, because stress is exhibited in, you know, behave, you know, if you stress out a cow, then she internalizes it and she changes her hormones and then they have less of an ability to, you know, to perform. Like everybody knows, you should feed your cows at a similar time of the day and you should have regular, predictable things in their life allows them to maintain, you know, more of the homeostatic state so they can make these like huge metabolic adjustments to support things like, you know, the growth of the fetus at the end and then, you know, milk production subsequently. And I think that, you know, we just really need to be aware of those things in the management of our animals and feeding them. And And I think, you know, the other thing I think is, you know, we talk about, you know, fat cows and that other thing and things to think about. I mean, certainly we don't want a really skinny cow going into it, but, you know, excessive food in across the mammals, like that's actually an excessive weight is one of the things that seems to be more detrimental to reproductive stuff, including with lactation, a continuum of reproduction. So, yeah. So I think that all of those things that we already kind of know, but we're all trying to understand a little bit better and we try tweaking them, I guess.
So this is going to maybe put you on the spot a little bit, but nobody has a good answer. So if you don't either, that's fine. But one thing I always feel bad that I cannot give a lot of good insights about is the seasonal slump in colostrum yield. And it's not only in the fall, but there's really good data now that on average cows make less colostrum in the fall. So that really becomes a pressure point for farms in the fall. And, you know, with your expertise in, you know, that adaptation to lactation and then also your circadian rhythm work, I'm curious if you've thought about that at all, or maybe that's not even really related to circadian rhythm.
You know, circadian meaning your daily rhythms, but certainly the inputs. I think a lot about seasonal rhythms. First, I will say this one thing: I didn't know that colostrum slumps in the fall. But I will say, you know, circadian rhythms and circadian rhythms evolved for a reason, right? And that's to you know, optimize our survival in ever-changing environments. And so ever-changing, they change every 24 hours and they change every 365 days. And so how can you optimize survival? I would think that, you know, so colostrum formation is, you know, has a lot to do with, you know, well, has everything to do with feeding the calf. I'm really into colostrum right now. Like I'm like into like, how does it set you for life and, you know, make more milk later on, but that's not what we're talking about right now. There's a reason for it. I think, Kevin Hartings, he does this review and on this whole thing. Actually, it's not even the review. It's a paper that he his former student, who's now a professor, I think, in Minnesota, Isaac Saffer, and they did the rhythms of the circadian rhythms of milk production, and I think it sort of goes along with that, like milk production starts to go down, and then some of it, like the it goes up like in starts to increase again with maximal in like February, March, and April. Naturally, I'm not talking about, you know, the photo period, which is it's all photo period. But I mean, I think probably it dips down is evolutionarily. I know cows are not seasonal breeders, but evolutionarily, it probably was not the ideal time for them to have it, and that they're really meant to have it in the springtime and prepare with the short day, you know, leaving really the short days and going into the spring. And so I think like we should just be really kind of cognizant of it. I don't think in the United States we're going to go to seasonal dairying at all. but we should like kind of realize that those are just things that happen. Are there ways we could manage our cows differently? Somehow they kind of know the season. Even mice, you know, I don't know if you know this, but they have like weird, like sometimes you can't get them to breed certain times a year, and they must read this, you know, they're in laboratory cages, so they have no idea what outside is, but they must.
Now the lights are on switches. And
I know. Yeah. Like such a controlled environment, but they seem to know what's going on the outside. So, so even if you, supposedly if you put animals in a cave, they still can sense circa annual changes. And I'm not quite sure, you know, maybe it's gravity or the moon or something, right? We sense all that stuff, you know, it's all there. We evolved with it. They do just has profound stuff. So is there anything we could do about it? I think be cognizant of it and then, maybe supplement. Yeah. Colostrum's a weird one though. It's not all lactocyte derived. So you kind of would have to, I'll say that's an opinion, although it's not, I mean, we know the IgGs are from circulation, but there's some Laura and I, Hernandez and I came up with like this hypothesis, like where's the fats are coming from and all that other stuff. And it's not all from lactocytes, right?
Yeah. We kind of treat it like just the first day of making milk and it's special milk, but probably mechanistically, it's not really the right way to think of it.
No, I don't think about it like that at all. Well, first of all, it's not milk, right? I would say, right? It's got really low lactose in it. It's formed during secretory differentiation and, you know, milk's after secretory activation. And so I should say, when I say differentiation, if people don't know what I'm saying there, we used to call it lactogenesis one, but the first part of pregnancy, the mammary gland multiplies like crazy and gets more epithelial cells, more ducts are expanding, all that other stuff. But then the cells start to differentiate and become cells that will make milk, right? And then by the end of gestation, pregnancy, right before the calf is born, those cells in the mammary gland are all poised to make milk. But they don't have their tight junctions. So like those are the junctions between cells that close and don't allow like blood products, you know, to get into the milk secretion. And they're actually open during that time during secretory differentiation. And that's when colostrum is formed. So colostrum allows products not that get into the milk, not to have to go at least through the lactocyte, the milk producing velar cell. So, you know, lactogenesis two is after secretory activation. And, after tight junctions close, and then the product has to come from the lactocyte. And so, the problem, we should probably go back to circadian rhythms because I talk too much about the mammary gland and what goes on. But I think that, colostrum, I think it's made from macrophages in there. I think probably have a lot of to do with some of the fats in there.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely opinion. If I ever got to do the research, I could see. But I think years ago, we did laser capture microdissection. So we could look at where the genes were expressed in the the cells that support the lactocytes and the lactocytes themselves, but in late gestation. And that's when colostrum's being formed. And so it comes from some like knowledge in what's going on in the non-epithelial cells, but that's for another day.
Yeah. I think it is fascinating though, to stop sometimes and be like, you know, we're trying to manage 1,000 cows and 40 employees or whatever. And to stop me, like, it's kind of shocking that you can feed this animal like corn silage and she turns it into.
And she turns it into milk. Or you ever see a goat? I mean, that's it. They're literally eating sticks, like dry sticks with on them. And they're making, it is incredibly amazing. It's beautiful. I mean, like, how can that happen? You know.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Want a herd management software designed for you? BovaSync is helping herds by managing data faster and easier. Contact BovaSync today to learn more. Jones Hamilton is proud to support this episode and support healthier environments with our pH control product, Surface. Surface controls ammonia, improves air quality, and supports hoof health to create healthier spaces for calves, cows, and the people who care for them. Backed by decades of experience in animal agriculture, Jones Hamilton helps producers leverage the power of pH to support herd health, welfare, and productivity. Learn more at JonesHamiltonAg.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergenschmidt Animal Nutrition. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Cow Manager, ahead of the herd together. Safe, simple, stop lack. Contact AHV for comfortable dry cow care. Adiseo, a global leader in nutritional solutions and the provider of SmartAmine N, the best-in-class rumen-protected methionine product for dairy producers who want to optimize milk production, capture more value from their components, and maintain their lifetime performance of their herds. For more product information and to calculate your return on investment when you balance your feed with amino acids, go to milkpay.com.
Well, we have three questions. We can't let you escape without answering these.
Okay.
So what's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
Yeah, I'd have to say the Journal of Dairy Science. I think it's a, you know, not just because I got to be on a section editor. I just think it is a really excellent resource. And, you know, having been on the end of having my papers rejected and now understanding like a little bit more of the peer review process, I have an appreciation that the scientist who submit and peer review and look at it, it's really high quality stuff. Where I think, yeah, there's less stuff. I feel good about the quality of science that's going in there. I guess that's how I'd have to say, like, if I was just thinking about science, that's what I would say about it. Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. Very cool. Thank you for your service in that way, by the way.
Yeah.
What about your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
Yeah, so I'm glad you sent these beforehand. I'm gonna make a book recommendation for both men and women out there. And I say this because rarely do my husband and I agree on a book. And I read this first. It's called 3 Day Road, and it's by Joseph Boyden. And it's about it's three main characters, two Native Canadian, Native American, and their aunt, or one of their aunt. And it's based on a true story. I think it's Pegamegabau. And I'm sorry if that's not his name. But he was a a sniper in World War I. And it is a fantastic story. I'm not a big, I like historical fiction a little bit because I can learn. But I'm not a big war person, but there's like one scene that there's a sniper inside a dead carcass of a horse. And then they talk about lice, and it really gets into World War I. Like, I never knew that stuff and never kind of really imagined that. And then the stories themselves, the three intertwining stories, are pretty amazing. So yeah, that's what I would recommend. I just reread Owen Meany, which is a lovely story too. Prayer for Owen Meany, which is really good.
Sounds like you're an avid reader. That's awesome.
I love to read. Yeah. Yeah. But maybe I should do it more.
That's, to me, one of the small negatives about the jobs we have is I guess I do so much reading during the day. I would like to read it, but you have to catch up at night too.
Yeah, no. That I think I go in feast and famine of reading. But yeah, given the opportunity, you can learn a lot of different things. And I like novels just because it's, yeah, a break from all the real stuff.
Yeah. All right, last question. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
I know. So I as you can see, philosophize? That's not the right. I get too philosophical.
Most people's answers to this would apply almost to any job. But, you know, if you don't talk to dairy producers every day, that's fine.
Yeah. So I can't define that. I think, quite honestly, it's... you know, whether it's a 35 head or a 3,000 head, at the end of the day, like if you can look out and feel proud of what you've done, I think that's how I would define success. And so if you're able to do that, and whether it's just seeing shiny coats of your animals and the smell of TMR, silage, the sweet smell of silage, I guess that's what I would say. Appreciating those aspects, I think is what makes success, yeah.
Absolutely. I like that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm the type of person who goes off on such tangents, and I didn't stay very focused.
This is not a podcast about focus. It's about interesting conversation.
I hope so.
Well, Dr. Teresa Casey, thanks again for joining today. It was a fun conversation.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. Take care.
This has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. And if you haven't liked the show, make sure you hit the button so you don't miss the next episode. And we will see you then.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.